5. Sweatshops save the planet. 1. War on fashion. In fall 2019, during London Fashion Week, hundreds of Extinction Rebellion activists protested the industry's impact on the climate. Some covered themselves in fake blood and lay down in the streets. In front of Victoria Beckham's fashion show, they held up signs that read, "Fashion equals ecocide," and "Business as usual equals the end of life on Earth." An Extinction Rebellion spokesperson said, "As a race, we are, quite literally, facing the end of days." About 200 Extinction Rebellion protesters staged a fake funeral march complete with a giant coffin and marching band. They walked down the Strand thoroughfare in central London and blocked traffic. They chanted and handed out pamphlets. The activists pointed to estimates suggesting that the fashion industry was responsible for 10% of all carbon emissions. More than a half dozen protesters in London, wearing blood-red dresses and white face paint, protested in front of H&M, a retailer that sells inexpensive, fast fashion. A post on Extinction Rebellion's Facebook page read, "The industry still adheres to an archaic system of seasonal fashions, adding pressure to relentlessly create new fashion from new materials." On its website, Extinction Rebellion wrote, "Globally, we produce up to 100 billion pieces of clothing a year, taking a terrible toll on the planet and people who make them. What's worse, new reports predict the apparel and footwear industry will grow by 81% by 2030, putting an unprecedented strain on already devastated planetary resources." The protests appear to have had an impact. A recent survey found that more than 33% of customers switched to brands they believe are more sustainable, and 75% indicated environmental sustainability is important to them when shopping for clothes. Others argue that fashion and other consumer product industries are inherently unsustainable, focused as they are on increasing consumption. Stopping people consuming is really the only way of having any impact at this point, which is a difficult message for many people to take on board, said an Extinction Rebellion activist. "As a communication tool, fashion is so influential," said another activist. "We all have to put clothes on, and that has power." Environmentalists target a range of consumer products, not just shoes and clothing. In 2011, Greenpeace activists protested Barbie doll maker Mattel in California. In a statement, Greenpeace told the Washington Post and other journalists that it targeted Mattel because the entertainment and toy manufacturer sourced from Asia pulp and paper, which Greenpeace said bought pulp made from wood taken from Indonesian rainforests. During the protest, a Greenpeace activist dressed like Barbie drove a pink bulldozer. "Do you think they will let me park this at the mall?" she asked onlookers. An activist climbed onto the roof of Mattel's headquarters in El Segundo, California, and unfurled a banner with the face of a despondent-looking Ken doll that read, "Barbie, it's over. I don't date girls that are into deforestation." But Mattel is hardly a major agent of deforestation. Compared to daily newspapers, Mattel's consumption of paper is minimal. The reason Greenpeace targeted Mattel wasn't because it was a major paper user, but because Barbie is such a recognized brand. Attacking the toy company was sure to attract media attention. The truth about clothing and other consumer items made in factories in poor and developing countries is actually the opposite of what Extinction Rebellion and Greenpeace claim. Rather than being the main culprit in the destruction of forests, factories have been and remain an engine for saving them. 2. Leaving the farm. In 1996, I left graduate school in Santa Cruz, California, and returned to San Francisco to work on activist campaigns with Global Exchange, Rainforest Action Network, and other progressive and environmental organizations. At the time, concern over the labor and environmental impact of manufacturing clothing and other products, from Barbie dolls to chocolates, was growing. So we decided to launch what we labeled a corporate campaign against one of the largest and most profitable multinational companies in the world. Our model was Rainforest Action Network's boycott against Burger King, which I had raised money for in high school. Our strategy was to target a big, well-recognized brand. We quickly settled on Nike. At the time, Nike had just started promoting its shoes by linking them with women's empowerment through sports for women and girls. My colleagues at Global Exchange and I decided to focus on women's rights. Already, Global Exchange had brought a Nike factory worker from Indonesia to tour the United States and talk publicly about what life was like in the apparel company's factories, generating extensive national publicity. We drafted an open letter to Phil Knight, the founder and then chairman of Nike. We circulated the letter among feminist leaders and provided a copy to the New York Times. In the letter, we asked that Nike allow local independent monitors to inspect its factories in Asia and increase wages. For example, its factory workers in Vietnam were making only $1.60 per day at the time. In fall 1997, the Times ran a story with the headline, "Nike supports women in its ads, but not its factories," groups say. The reporter wrote, "A coalition of women's groups have attacked Nike as hypocritical for its new television commercials that feature female athletes, asserting that something is wrong when the company calls for empowering American women but pays its largely female overseas workforce poorly." Our campaign seemed like a success. We had generated so much negative publicity that we damaged Nike's brand. As importantly, we sent a message to other corporations that they would be held accountable for conditions in factories they contracted with abroad. I go back to 1997 to find the first clearly corporate social responsibility-related event I can recall, the boycott of Nike, that had a real impact on the company, said Jeffrey Heal, a Columbia University Business School professor. Not everyone agrees that the Nike campaign was a success. Some, like Jeff Ballinger, whose work with Indonesian factory workers dates back to 1988, believes Nike hyped environmental sustainability as a public relations tool to overshadow continued human exploitation. The grinding outsource paradigm still rules in most low-skill manufacturing, wrote Ballinger. Meanwhile, environmental experts and activists say consumer product companies haven't done anything significant to improve their environmental practices. The mission of sustainable fashion has been an utter failure, and all small and incremental changes have been drowned by an explosive economy of extraction, consumption, waste, and continuous labor abuse, said activists in 2019. In June 2015, a few months after visiting Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda, I decided to go to Indonesia and see for myself what the situation was like for factory workers there. I hired a 24-year-old Indonesian journalist, Syarifa Nuraida, who calls herself Ipa. She had reported on labor issues at the factories and had recently uncovered military corruption. I was beaten up last year after I covered how military officers had bought up land for a low price, she told me. It was very scary for my parents, but they never insisted I quit. Ipa had arranged interviews with several factory workers for me, one of whom was a 25-year-old named Suparti, who had come from a small village on the coast. Her first job was at a Barbie factory, and her second at a chocolate factory. We met twice, first at Suparti's union office and again at her home. She wore a bright pink hijab, which she fastened with a large brooch. Every Sunday we spent playing in the water, but I never learned how to swim and never fully went in, she said. I lived in a strict Islamic community where we couldn't even go to social gatherings if men were there. Trips to the beach were infrequent. We rarely went to the beach because there was always so much work to do. After school, Suparti worked alongside her parents and siblings in the fields. We were poor relative to the other houses in the community. Our house had 4 rooms and was made of bamboo. We had no electricity or TV. We cooked with rice husks. Her family grew rice and a little bit of eggplant, chilies, and green beans. They rotated the rice crops with soy to fertilize the soil. She helped her parents tie spinach into bundles to sell at the local market. Some of the greatest threats Supardi and her family faced were wild animals, disease, and natural disasters. One time, wild dogs got loose in the village. My parents worried they would eat our rabbits, she explained. During the avian bird flu epidemic, my parents worried about their chickens, but they turned out to be okay. Everyone was scared of tsunamis and earthquakes because we lived so close to the sea, said Supardi. Some people were so scared they moved their stuff to the mountains. But then the volcano Merapi erupted. The rich people who had moved their stuff up into the hillside lost their belongings to the lava. We felt very vulnerable to nature. Eventually, Supardi was drawn to the city. As a child, I heard from my aunt about what it was like to work in a factory, and I imagined I would work in one. My parents didn't want me to. Stay here, do your chores, and wait for a good man to marry you, they said. My mother, in particular, didn't want me to go. I explained to them that I wanted to send money back to them. And so, after she turned 17 years old, Supardi left home. 3. Manufacturing progress. When young people like Supardi leave the farm for the city, they must buy food rather than grow it. As a consequence, the declining number of farmers in poor and developing countries must produce even more food. In Uganda, I had a conversation with a middle-aged woman who worked at our eco-lodge, where we went to see gorillas for a second time. I told her that just 2 out of every 100 Americans are involved in farming, whereas 2 out of every 3 Ugandans are farmers. How can you grow enough food? She asked. With very large machines, I replied. For more than 250 years, the combination of manufacturing and the rising productivity of farming have been the engine of economic growth for nations around the world. Factory workers like Supardi spend their money buying food, clothing, and other consumer products and services, resulting in a workforce and society that is wealthier and engaged in a greater variety of jobs. The declining number of workers required for food and energy production, thanks to the use of modern energy and machinery, increases productivity, grows the economy, and diversifies the workforce. While a few oil-rich nations like Saudi Arabia have achieved very high standards of living without ever having embraced manufacturing, almost every other developed country in the world, from Britain and the United States to Japan to South Korea and China, has transformed its economy with factories. Increased wealth from manufacturing is what allows nations to build the roads, power plants, electricity grids, flood control, sanitation, and waste management systems that distinguish poor nations like Congo from rich nations like the United States. Cities, meanwhile, concentrate human populations and leave more of the countryside to wildlife. Cities cover just more than 0.5% of the ice-free surface of the Earth. Less than 0.5% of Earth is covered by pavement or buildings. As farms become more productive, grasslands, forests, and wildlife are returning. Globally, the rate of reforestation is catching up to a slowing rate of deforestation. Humankind's use of wood has peaked and could soon decline significantly. And humankind's use of land for agriculture is likely near its peak and capable of declining soon. All of this is wonderful news for everyone who cares about achieving universal prosperity and environmental protection. The key is producing more food on less land. While the amount of land used for agriculture has increased by 8% since 1961, the amount of food produced has grown by an astonishing 300%. Though pasture land and cropland expanded 5 and 16%, between 1961 and 2017, The maximum extent of total agriculture land occurred in the 1990s and declined significantly since then, led by a 4.5% drop in pasture land since 2000. Between 2000 and 2017, the production of beef and cow's milk increased by 19 and 38%, respectively, even as total land used globally for pasture shrank. The replacement of farm animals with machines massively reduced land required for food production. By moving from horses and mules to tractors and combine harvesters, the United States slashed the amount of land required to produce animal feed by an area the size of California. That land savings constituted an astonishing one-quarter of total U.S. land used for agriculture. Today, hundreds of millions of horses, cattle, oxen, and other animals are still being used as draft animals for farming in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Not having to grow food to feed them could free up significant amounts of land for endangered species, just as it did in Europe and North America. As technology becomes more available, crop yields will continue to rise, even under higher temperatures. Modernized agricultural techniques and inputs could increase rice, wheat, and corn yields fivefold in sub-Saharan Africa, India, and developing nations. Experts say sub-Saharan African farms can increase yields by nearly 100% by 2050, simply through access to fertilizer, irrigation, and farm machinery. If every nation raised its agricultural productivity to the levels of its most successful farmers, global food yields would rise as much as 70%. If every nation increased the number of crops per year to their full potential, food crop yields could rise another 50%. Things are headed in the right direction regarding other environmental measures. Water pollution is declining in relative terms, per unit of production, and in absolute terms in some nations. The use of water per unit of agricultural production has been declining as farmers have become more precise in irrigation methods. High-yield farming produces far less nitrogen pollution runoff than low-yield farming. While rich nations produce 70% higher yields than poor nations, they use just 54% more nitrogen. Nations get better at using nitrogen fertilizer over time. Since the early 1960s, the Netherlands has doubled its yield while using the same amount of fertilizer. High-yield farming is also better for soils. 80% of all degraded soils are in poor and developing nations of Asia, Latin America, and Africa. The rate of soil loss is twice as high in developing nations as in developed ones. Thanks to the use of fertilizer, wealthy European nations and the United States have adopted soil conservation and no-till methods, which prevent erosion. In the United States, soil erosion declined 40% in just 15 years, between 1982 and 1997, while yields rose. As such, buying cheap clothing and thus increasing agricultural productivity is one of the most important things we can do to help people like Suparti in Indonesia and Bernadette in Congo, while also creating the conditions for the return and protection of natural environments, including rainforests. 4. The Great Escape. Suparti was happy and anxious to leave her home in the country for the big city. "I can remember the excitement I felt on taking a bus by myself," she recounted. "We left at 5 p.m. and arrived at 8 a.m. the next day. I only got 2 hours of sleep because I was so excited. I was met by my aunt and sister, who lived 30 minutes away and worked in a factory. My first interview was just 2 hours later at 10 a.m., and I screwed it up because they asked me my address and I didn't know it. I spent a week at my aunt's house, and then I went to an interview at the Mattel factory." Hundreds of young women had started lining up at 5 a.m. just to get a ticket to enter a lottery, from which candidates would be selected for interviews. Suparti arrived a couple of hours late, after the tickets were already gone, but was able to sneak into the factory with a friend when a security guard wasn't looking. Part of the interview was to put clothes and accessories on a Barbie doll, she said. We were judged on speed. As a girl, I had played with fake Barbie dolls. Plus, I knew this would be the test and was mentally prepared. The other tests included making a ponytail and putting shoes on the Barbie. The tests started at 10 a.m. 5 hours later, they announced who was being hired. I was faster than others and got the job, Supardi said. I was happy but not surprised because I thought I could do it. But the job, as well as the culture inside the Mattel factory, wasn't what Supardi imagined it would be. There was never any physical abuse, but there was constant yelling, she said, and I had never in my life been yelled at. Javanese people speak slowly and quietly. Sumatrans speak loudly. They don't mean to yell, but that's how they talk. I couldn't bear it. I was used to going to bed at 7 p.m., but now I worked late. One time I fell asleep on the line, and a manager came by and lifted up my chair, saying, "Wake up!" I cried every day after work. My family said, "It's okay. There are many kinds of people. Be patient in finding a new job," she said. They never said, "We told you so." Shortly after Supardi turned 18, she found employment at a chocolate factory. Her first job was to pour liquid chocolate into moldings and package them. Then she was promoted to deliver chocolate and supplies to other parts of the factory by trolley. And finally, she worked behind a desk, printing product labels, plastic wrap and expiration dates, and barcodes for retailers. Around the world, for hundreds of years, young women have been voting with their feet. They have moved to cities from the countryside, not because the urban areas are utopian, but because they offer many more opportunities for a better life. Urbanization, industrialization, and energy consumption have been overwhelmingly positive for human beings as a whole. From pre-industrial times to today, life expectancy extended from 30 to 73 years. Infant mortality declined from 43 to 4%. Before 1800, notes Harvard University's Steven Pinker, most people were desperately poor. The average income was equivalent to that in the poorest countries in Africa today, about $500 a year in international dollars, he writes. And almost 95% of the world lived in what counts today as extreme poverty, less than $1.90 a day. The Industrial Revolution constituted what Pinker calls the Great Escape from poverty. The Great Escape continues today. From 1981 to 2015, the population of humans living in extreme poverty plummeted from 44% to 10%. Our prosperity is made possible by using energy and machines, so fewer and fewer of us have to produce food, energy, and consumer products, and more of us can do work that requires greater use of our minds, and that even offers meaning and purpose to our lives. Moving to the city gives women more freedom in who they marry. My parents encouraged the ta'aruf, Muslim way of marriage, said Supardi. This is where you explain yourself to a religious teacher or preacher, and they will introduce you to someone they think is a good match, but it's still up to you. I'm still rebellious and thus would like to get to know the man before marriage. Cities and manufacturing bring other positive benefits. The human population growth rate peaked in the early 1960s, alongside rising life expectancy and declining infant mortality. Total population will peak soon, and thanks to rising agricultural productivity, the share of humans who are malnourished declined from 20% in 1990 to 11% today, about 820 million people. Consider the differences between Bernadette, Supardi, and Helen. Bernadette must produce all of her food and energy, whereas Supardi and Helen can purchase theirs. And while Supardi prepares most of her own food, Helen, as a working professional, is able to buy prepared food and even have it delivered to our home. While Bernadette must farm to live, Helen is wealthy enough that she can garden for pleasure. And while Helen must also ward off wildlife, namely moles, Our food supply and lives are not at risk if the rodents eat our plants, as Bernadette's is when a baboon does the same. Machines liberate women from drudgery. I once asked my mother's oldest sister what her happiest childhood memories were while growing up on their farm in Indiana. She recalled the day when a clothes wringer her mother had ordered from Sears arrived. It was little more than two rollers and a hand crank, but it spared my grandmother's hands the hard labor of pulling, squeezing, and twisting clothes. Later came the electric-powered washing machines and dryers that fully liberated women from having to wash, wring, and hang out to dry the family's clothes. Scholars, including Harvard's Benjamin Friedman and Steven Pinker, find that rising prosperity is strongly correlated with rising freedom among, reduced violence against, and greater tolerance for women, racial and religious minorities, and gays and lesbians. Such was the case in Indonesia. "My favorite singer is Morrissey," Ipa told me. "I went to his show last year and was nervous that Islamic extremists would threaten to bomb it and the show would be canceled. That's what happened with Lady Gaga, who had to cancel her show." "Why didn't they?" I asked. "Maybe they didn't realize that Morrissey is gay," she said. I asked Ipa if she disapproved of homosexuality. "Do I think it's a sin?" "Yes. You can tell when someone is gay because they wear super tight clothes. But I'm cool with people being gay. It's not going to affect me." 5. The power of wealth. In the 18th century, Britain pioneered the factory system, which combined people, machines, and energy in a way that made the manufacturing of clothing, shoes, and consumer products far faster and cheaper than the cottage-level home-based crafts system that predated it. In the opening chapter of his 1776 book, The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith explains that an individual worker is 50 times more productive when he is focused on a single task in making a pin than if he made the entire pin himself. Factories require people to harness energy to power machines. Owners built factories next to rivers so they could use water wheels. Over time, they transitioned to using steam, from coal to power factories, and then to electricity. Today, economists point to three reasons why manufacturing, as opposed to other sectors of the economy, has allowed poor nations to develop into rich ones. First, poor nations can become as efficient as rich nations in making things and even surpass them. It is relatively easy for poor nations to steal manufacturing secrets from rich ones. Americans stole factory know-how from Britain in the 18th and 19th centuries, just as China has stolen intellectual property from the United States and other nations in recent years. Second, goods made in factories are easy to sell to other countries. This allows developing nations to make things they cannot yet afford to buy, and to buy things that they themselves cannot yet make. Even when the rest of the economy isn't working because of high levels of corruption in government or other factors, history shows that factories can continue to be productive and, indeed, drive economic growth. Finally, factories are labor-intensive, which allows them to absorb large numbers of unskilled small farmers. Former farmers like Supardi don't need to learn a new language or special skills to work in factories. It is comparatively easy to turn a rice farmer into a garment factory worker, notes Harvard University economist Denny Roderick. During the last 200 years, poor nations found that they didn't need to end corruption or educate everyone to develop. As long as factories were allowed to operate freely and the politicians didn't steal too much from their owners, manufacturing could drive economic development, and over time, as nations became richer, many of them, including the U.S., became less corrupt. You could start with very poor initial conditions, get a few things right to stimulate the domestic production of a narrow range of labor-intensive manufacturers, and voila, you had a growth engine going, Roderick says. Such was the case with Indonesia. In the 1960s, It was as poor as many sub-Saharan African nations are today. A civil war and mass killings from 1965 to 1966 led to the deaths of more than 1 million people, or maybe more, according to recent estimates. The government was and remains famously corrupt. Recall that Ipo was beaten up after she uncovered Indonesia soldiers involved in a crooked real estate deal. And yet, for as dysfunctional and corrupt as Indonesia was, and in many ways still is, it has been able to attract enough manufacturing to drive development. Per capita annual incomes rose from $54 to $3,800 between 1967 and 2017. For Supartie, what that has meant is that her wages have more than tripled since she first started working in the city. As a factory worker, she was able to purchase a flat-screen TV, motor scooter, and even a home by the age of 25. In the early 2000s, a young Dutch economist named Arthur van Bentham was working for Shell Oil Company in the Netherlands to develop scenarios to predict future energy supply and demand. In the 1960s, Shell pioneered scenario planning, which is essentially creating plausible but distinct stories about what the future might bring. Such stories helped Shell anticipate oil price increases in the 1970s and reductions in the 1980s, and thus hedge its bets. To forecast market collapses, Shell's scenario planning depended on thinking in counterintuitive, contrarian ways, and continually seeking new evidence rather than relying on assumptions. Like many energy analysts at the time, Van Bentham assumed that more energy-efficient light bulbs, refrigerators, computers, and virtually every other technology meant that poor nations could get rich using far less energy than rich economies. Because all these energy-efficient technologies are also available in China and Asia today, said Van Bentham, you might expect to find lower growth in energy consumption than you had in the United States or Europe when they were at the same GDP levels. Van Bentham decided to try to determine whether such energy, leapfrogging, as it is called, had actually occurred. He created a database from data on GDP, energy prices, and energy consumption from 76 countries. He crunched the numbers. He found no evidence of leapfrogging. If anything, he told me, I found it slightly the other way around, that developing countries exhibit more energy-intensive growth at the same levels of GDP than developed countries did. Thanks to energy efficiency, things like lighting, electricity, and air conditioning are a lot cheaper. But that has just meant that people use them more, which reduces the energy savings that would have occurred had consumption levels not risen. The same has occurred for big, expensive, and energy-intensive products like cars. If you look at India today, one high-selling car, the Suzuki Maruti Alto, is a $3,500 very energy-efficient vehicle that gets 40 mpg, miles per gallon, Van Bentham explained. That's way more efficient than cars used in the United States a century ago. Since 1800, lighting has become 5,000 times cheaper. As a result, we use much more of it in our homes, at work, and outdoors. Cheap light-emitting diodes, LEDs, allow Supartie to consume much more lighting than our grandparents could when they were at similar income levels. And by making cars cheaper, more people can buy them, increasing energy consumption. The Suzuki Maruti Alto's much lower price and its higher efficiency allows a greater number of poorer Indians to use it, notes Van Bentham. Van Bentham's finding wasn't particularly new. The fact that energy efficiency, a form of resource productivity, lowers prices, which increases demand, is basic economics. And economists demonstrated that cheaper lighting led to greater consumption in 1996 and again in 2006. How wealthy we are is thus reflected in the amount of energy we consume. The average Congolese person consumes the energy equivalent of 1.1 kilograms of oil per day. The average Indonesian consumes the energy equivalent of 2.5 kilograms per day. The average U.S. citizen consumes 19 kilograms per day. But these numbers obscure huge differences in the quality of energy. Almost all of the average Congolese person's energy consumption is in the form of burning wood and other biomass, where just 24% of the average Indonesians is, and nearly none of the average Americans is. In the 7 years since we bought our home, Helen and I have not lit a fire in our fireplace once, and do not intend to do so in the future, because of the pollution it would create. Countries with high population density, like Germany, Britain, and Japan, consume less energy per person than population-diffuse places like California, thanks to reduced car usage, but nowhere near the levels of people like Suparti, much less Bernadette. As nations like Indonesia industrialize, they at first require more energy per unit of economic growth, but as they de-industrialize, like the United States, they require less. Globally, the history of human evolution and development is one of converting ever larger amounts of energy into wealth and power in ways that allow human societies to grow more complex. 6. Energy density matters. When you interview women who are small farmers about what it's like to cook with wood, you might assume they would complain about the toxic smoke they must breathe. After all, such indoor air pollution shortens the lives of 4 million people per year, according to the World Health Organization. But around the world, what they complain about more often is how much time it takes to chop wood, haul wood, start fires, and maintain them. After Suparti moved to the city, she was able to use liquefied petroleum gas as cooking fuel instead of rice husks. Doing so produces far less pollution, including one-third fewer carbon emissions. But more importantly, LPG saves her time she can spend doing other things. When coal is burned in a power plant miles away, smoke can be removed from the home entirely, even when cooking and heating with natural gas. But even burning coal indoors with the right fireplace produces less indoor pollution than burning wood. Humans have been moving away from wood to fossil fuels for hundreds of years. Globally, wood went from providing nearly all primary energy in 1850 to 50% in 1920 to just 7% today. As we stop using wood for fuel, we allow grasslands and forests to grow back and wildlife to return. In the late 1700s, the use of wood as fuel for cooking and heating was a leading cause of deforestation in Britain. In the United States, per capita consumption of wood for fuel peaked in the 1840s. It was used at a per capita rate that was 14 times higher than today. Fossil fuels were thus key to saving forests in the United States and Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries. Wood went from being 80% of all primary energy in the United States in the 1860s to 20% in 1900, before reaching 7.5% in 1920. The environmental and economic benefits of fossil fuels are that they are more energy dense and abundant. A kilogram of coal has almost twice as much energy as a kilogram of wood, while a kilogram of Suparti's liquefied petroleum gas has three times the energy as the rice husk biomass she cooked with back on the farm. Centralizing energy production has been essential to leaving more of planet Earth for natural landscapes with wild animals. Today, all hydroelectric dams, all fossil fuel production, and all nuclear plants require less than 0.2% of the Earth's ice-free land. The Earth's food production takes 200 times more land than this. While the energy density of coal is twice as high as the energy density of wood, the power density of coal mines is up to 25,000 times greater than forests. Even 18th century coal mines were 4,000 times more power dense than English forests and 16,000 times more power dense than crop residues, like the kind Supartis' family used. The more people and wealth an area has, the higher the power density. Manhattan has a power density 20 times higher than New York City's outer boroughs, and the wealthy island nation of Singapore has a power density 7 times higher than that of the global urban average. Thanks to fertilizers, irrigation, petroleum-powered tractors, and other farm machines, the power densities of farms rise tenfold as they evolve from the labor-intensive techniques used by Supartis' parents to the energy-intensive practices used on California's rice farms. Power-dense factories and cities require energy-dense fuels because they are easier to transport and store, and they pollute less. Horse-drawn carriages made New York City unlivable in the years before the introduction of the automobile. The streets were dirty and dusty and stank of urine and feces, which brought flies and disease. Petroleum-powered vehicles allowed for much higher power densities with much less pollution. During the last 250 years, the power density of factories has increased dramatically. By the 1920s, Henry Ford's River Rouge Complex factory in Detroit had a power density 50 times higher than that of America's first large, integrated clothing factory, the Merrimack Manufacturing Company, 100 years earlier. That 50-fold increase in power density between Merrimack and River Rouge was made possible through electricity, which is the flow of electrons, the subatomic particles that are technically matter, but act as a kind of pure, matterless energy. Electricity is, technically, an energy carrier, not a fuel or primary energy. Nevertheless, the increase shows the power of humankind's evolution away from matter-dense fuels to energy-dense ones. People are often willing to accept even high levels of air pollution to enjoy the benefits of electricity. In 2016, I interviewed people living around an old and dirty coal power plant in India. The plant provided them with free electricity, but also sometimes emitted toxic ash, which they said irritated and burned their skin. However much they hated the pollution, none said they would be willing to give up the free, dirty electricity for cleaner electricity at a cost. Even coal burning has become dramatically cleaner over the last 200 years. A simple technical fix added to coal plants in developed nations after 1950 reduced dangerous particulate matter by 99%. High-temperature coal plants are nearly as clean as natural gas plants, save for their higher carbon emissions. Natural gas is still, as a rule, superior to coal for inherently physical reasons. But on the question of air pollution, the extent to which coal plants have become far cleaner is remarkable. None of this is to say that burning coal is good, only that it is, on most human and environmental measures, better than burning wood. As we will see, natural gas is similarly better than coal on most measures. People burn wood, not coal, and coal, not natural gas, when those fuels are all they can afford, not because those are the fuels they would prefer. As a result of cleaner burning coal, the transition to natural gas, cleaner vehicles, and other technological changes, developed nations have seen major improvements in air quality. Between 1980 and 2018, U.S. carbon monoxide levels decreased by 83%, lead by 99%, nitrogen dioxide by 61%, ozone by 31%, and sulfur dioxide by 91%. While death rates from air pollution can rise with industrialization, they decline with higher incomes, better access to health care, and reductions in air pollution. Despite this positive trend, the shift from biomass to fossil fuels is far from complete. Humans today use more wood for fuel than at any other time in history, even as it constitutes a lower share of total energy. Ending the use of wood for fuel should thus be one of the highest priorities for people and institutions seeking both universal prosperity and environmental progress. 7. The Manufacturing Ladder. The real risk to forests comes not from the expansion of energy-intensive factories in poor nations, as Greenpeace and Extinction Rebellion claim, but rather from the declining need for them. On one hand, Africa has made real progress during the last half century. Agricultural productivity has risen, but manufacturing was a higher percentage of the economy in the mid-1970s than it is today. Most countries of Africa are too poor to be experiencing de-industrialization, writes Roderick, but that is precisely what seems to be taking place. One exception is Ethiopia, which has attracted Calvin Klein, Tommy Hilfiger, and fast fashion leader H&M, both because of its low wages compared to places like China and Indonesia, where they have risen, as well as to its investments in hydroelectric dams, the electricity grid, and roads. Ethiopia has experienced GDP growth of more than 10% per annum over the last decade, notes Roderick, due in large part to the increase in public investment from 5% to 19% of GDP. Ethiopia had to end and recover from a bloody 17-year civil war, which resulted in at least 1.4 million deaths, including 1 million from famine, before its government could invest in infrastructure. The resources spent on investment in basic infrastructure such as roads and hydroelectricity appear to have been well spent, says Roderick. The infrastructure investments have raised the overall productivity of the economy and reduced rural poverty. Leadership matters. To be successful, industrialization has to come from the very top. Hin Din, a former World Bank economist who advised the Ethiopian government, told me. For over two decades, Din has researched and written on how poor nations can attract manufacturing. Ethiopia got good results because of the now-deceased Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, who went to China to get garment and shoe factories. I asked Din if he shared Roderick's view that poor nations might need to find a path to development other than manufacturing. In the U.S., manufacturing employment peaked at 20 million people in 1978, said Din, and since then, it has shed its low-end industries to focus on higher, more specialized manufacturing. That's different from Nigeria de-industrializing at 7 or 8% share of manufacturing in GDP before its manufacturing reached the maturity stage. Din added, in a lot of developing countries, the de-industrialization is due to poor policy, bad governance, or neglect, not because of some natural peak, as the case of the U.S. or Europe. Din dismissed the notion that China's high productivity made the expansion of manufacturing in African nations irrelevant. In the developing world, everyone, rich or poor, needs simple things like chairs or shoes, he said. But when I was in Zambia, I went to buy shoes, but not a single pair was made in Zambia. In any country, poor or rich, you have a lot of consumer goods that have to be produced, he explained. The number of goods produced in the household only increases over time with income and never stops. I'm referring to the basic necessities of clothing, shoes, and household items. Din observed the same phenomenon as Van Bentham. What our grandparents had is completely different from what we have, and we will produce a lot more. I have no fear that at one point the industrialization will stop because demand will be saturated. I asked Din if poor nations could become rich ones through agriculture, as Brazil has been attempting. There is nothing wrong with growing through agriculture, said Din, but historically, nations did not do it that way because the scope for innovations is fairly limited. We're better at producing a bushel of wheat today than we were 50 years ago, but the wheat is pretty much the same. By contrast, a TV today and a TV 30 years ago are two completely different products. He pointed to the difference between South Korea, whose per capita GDP is $30,000, and Argentina, where it is $14,000. Argentina in 1920 had a higher per capita income than Italy and higher than Korea. While there are many factors involved, One cannot help but observe that Korea's development path has been based on manufacturing and Argentina on other things, especially agriculture. If Congo ever got its act together, I asked Din, what should it do? I was asked to advise Osun State in Nigeria, he said. I advised them to open up to foreign direct investment and try to get as many jobs created as possible. For now, forget about who owns them. Just bring them over. Get in touch with the Chinese or Vietnamese or Malaysians and ask them to bring factories over. There is no shortcut to success, Din emphasizes. I gave a lecture at the Harvard Africa Business Club, and someone said, we don't want to produce clothing and start with cheap products like China. We want to go right to the higher value added. But you can't go directly from making bicycles to making a satellite. First, you make bicycles, and that allows you to make motorcycles. From there, you can go to automobiles. From automobiles, you can start thinking about satellites. The goal in Ethiopia is to have as many jobs as possible and have the education system turning out the factory workers that you need. That's why I push for light manufacturing. It's not just the skills, but also the discipline instilled in people. Later on, when the country reaches the second stage, the education system should produce more skilled workers capable of producing medium-tech products, and so on. Governments should train small farmers how to be factory workers, argues Din. When industrialization first started in Vietnam in the early 1990s, you would see women and girls in the countryside going from the fields to informal shops in the village to do some sewing. They would make clothing that would then be sold domestically and for export. There was a culture of when your clothes were torn, you sewed them up with needle and thread. That really helped. 8. Fast fashion for Africa. Contrary to what I and others have long believed, the positive impacts of manufacturing outweigh the negative ones. We should thus feel pride, not guilt, when buying products made by people like Supartie, and environmentalists and the news media should stop suggesting that fast fashion brands like H&M are behaving unethically for contracting with factories in poor nations. That doesn't mean we shouldn't want companies like Mattel, Nike, and H&M to improve factory conditions. Consumers can play a positive role in pressuring companies to do the right thing. But that depends on them continuing to buy cheap products produced in developing nations in the first place. Many demographers believe that how quickly the human population peaks and starts to decline globally depends on how quickly sub-Saharan nations like the Congo industrialize. People like Bernadette move to the city, get jobs in factories, earn money, and choose to have fewer kids. Understanding this process leads to an apparently counterintuitive conclusion. If you want to minimize carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in 2070, you might want to accelerate the burning of coal in India today, said MIT climate scientist Kerry Emanuel. It doesn't sound like it makes sense. Coal is terrible for carbon. But it's by burning a lot of coal, they make themselves wealthier, and by making themselves wealthier, they have less children. The population doesn't grow, and you don't have as many people burning carbon. You might be better off in 2070. Late economic developers like the Congo have a much harder time competing in international markets than did early economic developers like the United States and Europe. That means early developers, today's rich nations, should do everything they can to help poor nations industrialize. Instead, as we will see, many of them are doing something closer to the opposite, seeking to make poverty sustainable rather than to make poverty history. Before we left, I asked Supartie what she felt she had accomplished as a labor union organizer. My proudest accomplishment was to win menstrual leave, she said, so that when you are on your period, you can have 2 days off. This was good because we had co-workers who were in so much pain from their periods that they cried, and one even fainted. I asked her whether she was lonely and thought about returning to the village. I really miss home, she confessed, especially the nice chats with my mom and her cooking. But I don't have any desire to go back. I'm grateful to be doing what I'm doing. I asked Supartie if she was worried about her parents. I'm not worried yet about their retirement, but I am, however, saving up money to be able to send them to Mecca as a gift. Supardi told me that once she's married, she would prefer to stay home and be a housewife. She'd like to have 4 children. I used to want to have 2 kids, but now I think the house will be too quiet, and I don't want to be alone. Before we left, I asked Supardi if I could take a photograph of her. Where? She asked. I told her to choose her favorite part of the house. She decided to stand next to a sewing machine she rarely used. In front of and on top of the sewing machine's arm, Supardi had placed framed photographs of family and friends, plastic flowers, and tiny toy electric guitars. In the photo I took, she rests her left arm on the helmet of her motor scooter. Above her is a Muslim prayer rug. Supardi smiles and looks proud.